The Athletic FC Podcast Network.
Hello, I'm Taylor Payne, and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your Are We Back Again? What a Roller Coaster Newcastle United podcast from The Athletic FC. It's great to have two lovely chaps with me here today. George Corkins here. How are we doing, George?
Well, I don't know. Am I coming or going, Taylor? I don't know. Am I happy? Am I sad? Am I excited? Am I miserable? What are we learning this season about Newcastle, or indeed about ourselves? I think, like, do not draw any conclusions about anything. Just live in the moment.
Yeah. Expect the unexpected, I think.
Expect the unexpected. So it's Monday morning, so I'm feeling pretty good, having seen Newcastle get back to winning ways in some style on Saturday, but I'm not drawing any conclusions from that. I'm just living it day by day.
You should, George. It would be silly to draw conclusions.
Thank you.
Speaking of silly, Chris Watts here. Chris, you all right?
I'm not too bad, thank you. Yes, I'm not too bad. I'm still reeling from Saturday, A, because of what happened on the pitch, and B, because for once, George Corkin actually complimented my sweet choice that I brought, you know, little sweets that we
What did you have? What did you take?
Well, we had some traditional sports mixtures and also some cola cubes.
Oh, cola cubes, great shout.
Both very old school. Great shout. Yeah, sports mixture had licorice in, which I'm a fan of.
Yes.
And the kind of the paper around the packets was sort of disintegrating. It was good. And yeah, now that Chris is sort of back with us live, as it were, we have to say, I mean, last heard Chris on a train sounding more miserable possibly than he's ever sounded before, ever. So it's nice to have him back, and nice that he's got a little grin on his lovely little face.
Did you enjoy your little trip down south, Chris?
No, I just shut myself inside for a week, and that's why I wasn't on the podcast last week. I couldn't come outside until St. James's on Saturday, and I feared that I was going to have sort of, you know, it was going to be a repeat of that. But no, thankfully, yeah. Saturday was a lot better, not only because I didn't have to go south, but also because of what we were reporting on.
Absolutely. Right, then, let's crack on, chaps. A lower table side coming to St. James's and parking the bus has been our kryptonite this season, hasn't it? So it was nice to have one of them make the confounding decision to not do that at all. Leicester, Chris, were a bit open, weren't they?
There were. I mean, we're going to come on to it in a bit, but basically Newcastle actually started poorly. But beyond that, if you take the 90 minutes as a whole, Leicester's approach was absolutely baffling. I mean, the way that we're speaking to people who watch Leicester and cover Leicester have said that Ruud van Nistelrooy sort of set up since he's come in, I sort of thought that he might have a bit of a go. But what I didn't understand was, not only did Leicester play with a high line, not only were Leicester extremely open, not only did Leicester at times try to press high, I didn't really understand what the game plan was. No. There didn't seem to be a specific game plan, and all it seemed to do was just play into Newcastle's hands and allow Newcastle to play in exactly the way that they want to play, rather than the sort of difficulties you mentioned, kryptonite, that they've had against teams with maybe a low block or teams who let Newcastle have the ball this season. Instead, it was at times let Newcastle have the ball, but also let them have plenty of space all over the pitch, which thankfully suited Newcastle down to the ground.
Yeah, shout out to Ollie, our magnificent producer, who said before the match, said hopefully Ruud van Nistelrooy will sort of be too proud to come here and park the bus. And I agree entirely with Chris, but I sort of want to reiterate, it's just astonishing. I'm not the kind of person, either as a fan, as a journalist or whatever, to ever sort of criticise managers for being naive or things like that, because someone like Ruud van Nistelrooy knows more about football than I ever will. But I'm just astonished in this sort of moment when Newcastle are really struggling against teams who put people behind the ball, why he just didn't decide to try and keep it tight for 20 minutes to frustrate Newcastle, frustrate the crowd. That would have made for a very tense St. James's Park. And ultimately, after the first 5 minutes, it was a tension-free afternoon for Newcastle. They got a clear run. They were allowed to do whatever they wanted. So Newcastle played well. By the end, it's a convincing victory. It's a thrashing. It was lovely. Everyone was singing very happy Christmas songs. It was kind of a great afternoon. But Leicester more than played their part in that. They gave Newcastle so much. They were like, they proved to be the ideal opponent. So I think that has to be the starting point for everything that we say on this pod.
Yeah.
That's also why it's quite difficult to sort of draw conclusions, because they just didn't make it tough for Newcastle at all.
Yeah.
So I found it really bizarre. Leicester's approach.
Absolutely. It was a big day, the start of a big week for our season. And Bruno made his feelings clear in the programme, Chris, didn't he?
He did. So when Newcastle have the leadership group column, as it's been basically since Eddie Howe's come in, and it was Bruno Guimaraes, the first team captain, who did the notes this time before the game, one of the quotes within it was, "When things don't go right, it's normal to be upset, but we also have to be together. We can also put our friendships to one side when needed. To be a true group, sometimes you need to have discussions and strong words." He also then went on to say that Newcastle can't just put in performances against the big six, as he referred them. He says we have to do it against other teams in the Premier League. And obviously, that comes off the back of the Brentford defeat that Newcastle have done a lot of soul searching during the week. Eddie Howe spoke afterwards about how they changed things up a little bit internally to try and sort of evoke a response. And clearly the players actually did take responsibility, and there was a recognition that they can't just be these sort of big game players, as has become the accusation over the course of the last few months, because Newcastle's record, certainly at St. James's Park against the big sides, is very, very good, whereas the record against other teams is pretty poor. I mean, I wrote about this in my piece, that if you actually look at it, before Saturday's game, Newcastle had played 7 matches against teams in the top half of who started the day in the top half of the Premier League, and 7 against teams who'd started in the bottom half. Their record against teams in the bottom half was, so you remove Southampton on the opening day, because obviously the table had been set. Newcastle had won just 1 of those games against Wolves, lost 3, drawn 3, and averaged 0.9 points. Whereas when they played top 10 teams from the 7 games, they'd had 3 wins, 2 draws, and 2 defeats, with an average points return of 1.6. So that was the sort of pressure Newcastle had going into this Leicester game. Everyone knew there was pressure. Eddie Howe spoke afterwards about pressure, and they sort of almost tackled it head on and addressed it, and seemingly that worked, albeit they had a very compliant Leicester side up against them.
They certainly did.
Yeah, and by the end of the afternoon, Bruno was talking on Match of the Day, saying, "We are capable of big things." And I think that's very important. You know, last week on the pod, we mentioned that Alan Shearer, Alan from work, there was that little clip from him. He wrote a very powerful column last week about Newcastle drifting, about the whole project being at a crossroads. All of those observations, I think, are still very, very valid. But one of the big points he made was that if you're a big player, you can't just turn up at home against the big teams. You've got to do it every week. You've got to find a way of doing that. And whether those players, whatever their futures hold, there is still a season in which Newcastle can make an impact. They can still do things. It's very difficult to play with absolutely the same intensity and alacrity and all of those sort of things that you do against Liverpool. But you've got to find a way of doing it. Anyway, they did it. And I think that's very important. They've got to keep doing it. And it was something that I talked to Lewis Hall, the outstanding Lewis Hall, after the match.
We compete against all the top six to a really good level, and I'd say a lot of the games that we've played against them, we should have maybe won. So, we look to continue to do that. But then also, when you're playing against the lesser teams, that's when you need to turn up as well, and you can't just turn up and get them in big games. So, I think today was a good result for us.
Is the kind of frustration in the dressing room about the way the season has gone in terms of the league, those things that you...
Slightly, but I think if I'm being completely honest, I don't think it's a major, major issue at the minute, just because of how close the table is. I think a couple of wins and it puts you right back up there. So, we've obviously beaten Leicester today, and then next league game, Ipswich, is a game that we look to win that as well. So.
After a horrendous opening 2 minutes, the match sort of settled into a familiar pattern, didn't it? At first, that involved Newcastle United having a lot of chances and not scoring any goals, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, inside 2 minutes, Newcastle had given the ball away 3 times inside their own half. Fabian Scher, Jacob Murphy, and
Tino Livramento,
yeah. So the 3 of them had given the ball away, and Jamie Vardy had sort of pounced on one of them. And at one point, you thought maybe Jamie Vardy a few years ago would have been almost bearing down on goal, and it could have been issues. And it felt very nervy inside St. James's Park. It really did early on. And understandably, it was such a huge match, and maybe that had sort of seeped through the players. And again, Newcastle lost, or Bruno Guimaraes did not win another toss, and Newcastle were shooting towards the Gallagher end in the first half. Now, just to rake over old calls, why not? It was interesting because somebody messaged me yesterday and sort of said, you know, maybe Woff has finally been vindicated about the way that Newcastle can attack. But the problem is they have to actually score in the first half. And I think if you look back at actually the games up to this point of the season, and this is sort of in retrospect and in hindsight, maybe applying too much of it, but the last half an hour of the West Ham game, the last half an hour of the Brighton game, Newcastle had nothing. And if you think about it, we weren't offering anything. And they'd been shooting the wrong way, as it has been historically. And maybe it's because they had actually blown themselves out in that. And that goes against my sort of theory. But actually, if Newcastle don't take the lead and don't go ahead against sides if they play that way, then that may be psychologically as much as physically has affected them. Thankfully, after a very bad opening 2 to 5 minutes against Leicester, they took control of the match, and it was chance after chance after chance. And until the first goal came after half an hour, you were sort of sat there thinking, they could be made to pay for some of these misses.
There was that moment, Chris, wasn't there? So Newcastle had given the ball away 3 times. We're looking at each other thinking, oh dear, this is like dodgy here. Hamza Choudhury's on the ball. He's starting a game in the Premier League, I think, for the first time in 2 years. A player, of course, that Steve Bruce had tried to sign on loan.
Yes.
After the club had shut up business in, I think it was the final transfer window before the takeover, sort of this symbol of kind of malaise. And there would have been something sort of darkly poetic at a time when you're questioning Newcastle's forward momentum if this symbol had like scored a goal or done something important. Anyway, thankfully that didn't materialise. It was a nervous start, but thankfully it settled down after that. But dear me, giving the ball away, yeah, exactly. Jamie Vardy sort of there, ready to break, didn't feel good, but thankfully that didn't last.
Instead, Hamza Choudhury's first Newcastle appearance went very, very well for them.
He was one of our better players, wasn't he? He was very good. Jacob Murphy missed one of those chances we were speaking about, a very, very good opportunity, fell on his left foot. It seemed like time stood still in that moment when that ball dropped to Jacob Murphy. And all I thought was, he's just going to slot this in the corner. I thought, there's no way he can possibly miss that from there. But he just...
Well, there was two.
Blazed it wide, didn't
he? There was one which was was flagged for offside, which was from further out. It was further out, but it was almost the identical sort of way that he tried to approach the ball. The second one came from Gordon cut the ball back to Joe Linton, and his shot was blocked to
that
Murphy
one,
in the box.
Yeah, that's the one I mean.
And then he sort of left foot, and then it was quite a bad miss in terms of how far it went wide. I mean, it was with his weaker foot. But
the way that his body shaped, he was like trying to pass it into the net, wasn't it? It was like not instinctive. It was like he was trying too hard to do it. And of course, you know, there was a bit of a reaction from the Gallagate, from the crowd. It was just that sort of instant sort of feeling of disappointment. And of course, he made reference to that. You could tell when he actually did score.
Yeah, luckily he had another chance very soon after that, and that self-imposed deadlock was broken. A lovely corner move with Lewis Hall and Sandro Tonali.
Now listen, Taylor. I'm going to interrupt you, and I'm going to be Chris Woff here.
Oh, you're going to describe it? Come on, then.
I don't know what it was, but I was sort of watching it at the time, and I don't know if Chris sort of maybe had his head down a little bit, but I was like, I just feel like I was living in the moment, and I can still sort of recall it with that sort of instant thing. And I thought the interesting thing was that I just happened to be looking at the right place at the right time, I think, because I was looking at Jason Tindall. Now, like all red-blooded males, like, you know, just like all human beings, my eyes are naturally drawn to the mahogany god on our touchline. But Newcastle won a corner. Jacob Murphy won the corner, actually. And Tindall gestures for everybody to sort of stop, to slow down. And then he did it was Lewis Hall on the ball to take the corner, wasn't it? Am I right? Having said I'm going to describe it, and
yes,
I need
was,
to dip,
yes.
make sure I do it right. So Lewis Hall's on the ball at the corner flag, and Tindall then does a sort of reverse fist pump. He sort of brings his hand to his own body, and what he's signalling for there is a short corner. And what happens is Hall plays it short to Tonali, who gets it. Suddenly Gordon's on the overlap, and he gives the ball to Gordon. Gordon is just in acres and acres of space.
Yeah.
And again, you know, said at the start, we have to keep drawing attention to how poor Leicester were. He has time and space to pick out Murphy, who's on the edge of the area, runs in, and this time, absolutely no mistake. It's a beautiful goal, so simple. And, yeah, not trying to suggest that Newcastle are the new Arsenal when it comes to corners and set pieces, but it was a really, really good, well-worked set piece, and that is, of course, Jason Tindall's speciality. That is one of the things that he does, and so you have to say it was a really good set piece, and it did feel like sort of time stopped in that moment. So I wanted to describe that.
And you did it beautifully, didn't you?
Yeah. You did pretty well, yeah. I mean, other than forgetting who actually started the move, but yeah, beyond that, no, you did pretty well. But DDL, we know, is not your strong point. But
you're welcome.
When you mention that it's what part of Tindall is responsible for, is also Stephen Purchase, the first team coach, and Kieran Taylor, who's a set piece analyst. Newcastle don't have a specialist set piece coach, which has been a big talking point from fans up to this point this season, because their record from set pieces has been poor in terms of actually finishing them. Partly, I think that's because Kieran Trippier has been in the side far less frequently, and so their effectiveness has decreased. But going into the game, Newcastle, only 15.8% of their 19 goals this season, three of them had come from dead ball situations, which was the sixth worst return in the Premier League. But their XG was actually 4.51 from them. So not massively better, but they were underperforming what they should have done from those set piece situations. That ranked 11th out of the 20 clubs. But there was some fans talking about Newcastle don't work on this, and you know, why don't they have these specialist routines? And they have actually had them, they just haven't worked, and they haven't been as effective. Yeah. Now, against Leicester, as George mentioned, they had a very, again, compliant side, who just basically, for some reason, for both goals, because the second goal is also from a set piece, but that's, rather than from a corner, it comes from a well-worked free kick. And I say a well-worked free kick, which it was, but it was also just, it's actually embarrassing to watch from a Leicester point of view, because Gordon has a free kick in the centre of the pitch. He hits it to the sort of back, behind the back left-hand post. Lewis Hall's completely unmarked, heads it across the box. And there's three Newcastle players who could head the ball in. No Leicester player anywhere near them. And it's Bruno Guimaraes who actually heads it in. But it was so important for Newcastle to capture those opportunities, because they get the first goal having missed in open play from a set piece. And then the second one, which comes just the start of the second half and basically kills the game at that stage, because we're still nervous at half-time. But Newcastle set pieces, are they starting to come together? Well, I mean, it's only a small bank of evidence, but this shows the work that they do put in, and finally it has paid dividends. They needed to pay dividends more frequently, they need the delivery to be more consistent, they need to carry it out and all these routines out far better if they are going to use them. But it was promising to see that, and to see that if Newcastle are struggling in open play, if they just can't take those chances that they've had far too frequently so far this season, they can revert to set pieces, which is sort of how Arsenal are still in the title hunt, really, because they've had to revert to those sort of set-piece situations.
They had a good chance as well for Dan Byrne, which was from a short corner. They've obviously been working on these, and it was a shame that Dan headed it over, but that was a great opportunity.
There's a lot of haters in football. There's a lot of jealousy. I think it's testament to Newcastle.
On the theme of Jason Tindall as well, chaps, it was a good day for him all round, wasn't it? The fans serenading him with Last Christmas. And he was had a little bit of needle with Ruud van Nistelrooy as well at one point.
Were you leading the chorus of that Last Christmas?
It was kind of old school, wasn't it? It was old school Newcastle in that sense. So, yeah, very nice. This year, to save you from tears, I'll give it to Jason Tindall, all that sort of stuff, and singing Eddie Howe and Jason Tindall in the second half. It was just a good day for Newcastle. And yeah, there was that moment, I think it was late on in the game, a Leicester player went down. Newcastle players kind of stood around. I think Sean Longstaff was kind of on the ball, like shrugging, what do I do? Do we keep playing? And eventually the referee blew for a stoppage to check on the Leicester player, and in the meantime Van Nistelrooy had gone a bit spare towards the fourth official. Tindall got involved. The two of them were then getting involved. They had a nice embrace at the end of the match. It was just one of those sort of very brief moments, but good to see Jason in the thick of things again. And it's, you know that everything is well in the Newcastle United world when we're able to sing songs about Jason Tindall.
But absolutely.
I think with those set pieces, you mentioned that Dan Byrne chance. Dan Byrne, I thought, really excellent again.
Yeah.
I mean, we probably don't mention him every week, but we should, because he's absolutely one of Newcastle's player of the season. But yeah, that short corner from Murphy, Gordon crosses it in, beautiful. Again, it's pretty much everybody unmarked, so you have to make that point.
But Leicester weren't defending zonally, they were defending fictionally, weren't they?
defending theoretically.
Yes, absolutely.
They were definitely defending theoretically.
Yes. Martin Dubravka was in nets for Newcastle, of course, with Nick Pope facing a bit of a spell on the sidelines. That went better for him than Danny Ward's half-time introduction went for Leicester, Chris, didn't it?
Was in nets. Are you five?
Yes. He was in nets. He was between the sticks.
but yes.
Yeah.
But,
he was playing rookie goalie.
So Pope looks to be out for about a month, suffered an injury while kicking the ball at Brentford. So that's a frustration for Newcastle. We know how important he is and how much the team suffered to a certain degree last season when he was unavailable. Yeah. I mean, Martin Dubravka had a very quiet afternoon. He only had to save one shot, which was from McAtee, and even that was fairly routine. That would have done his confidence a world of good. It was another clean sheet, which is positive because it was Newcastle's first in five games. But yeah, Danny Ward was brought on at half-time after an injury to Leicester's goalkeeper. And his first two actions, basically, were to pick the ball out of his own net.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
Not exactly the introduction you want at half-time at St James's Park as the opposition goalkeeper. But from a Newcastle point of view, very, very pleasing.
Something I noticed as well about Martin Dubravka, the defence seemed to be giving the ball to him a lot more. In the build-up, they seemed to be trusting him with the ball to his feet, and he was playing a lot higher up than what you normally see Nick Pope play. He seemed to be coming out and joining in with the build-up. It was an interesting one, that.
Well, I think that he does play more in terms of he comes out higher to play with his feet,
yeah.
But he isn't necessarily as comfortable coming out of his goal. So I think part of the reason why he is so high is because of that, is because Nick Pope naturally is quite willing to come and cover that space, whereas Dubravka is more comfortable on the ball. And also because Leicester was so toothless, I think it was also that allowed him to do that. But there is more trust in him. I think that it's not something that they talk about inside Newcastle, and there's certainly no directive for players not to give the ball to Nick Pope to his feet. But, you know, players are perceptive. I think they realise that actually, if we pass the ball back to Nick Pope too frequently and he has to use his feet, then it's likely that he's going to try and hoof the ball, and sometimes quite often directly out of play. So
yeah.
I think that's part of the reason behind that as well.
Fair play. There was two-headed goals, of course. The Bruno one we mentioned before with that set piece, and Alexander Isak as well, a nice early Christmas present from Leicester for him. Man of the match talk. Anthony Gordon was everywhere, doing everything, looked like he was really up for it. And Lewis Hall as well, who we mentioned before. Who gets it? Or just let them share it, given how well they combined, Chris. They were brilliant, those two, on that left-hand side.
They were, and that partnership hopefully is starting to sort of blossom. And it's interesting now that the dynamic, certainly in the Champions League qualification season, but even for a large extent of last year, was that the right-hand side was where Newcastle focused attack, certainly on Saturday, but I think more and more it's becoming the left-hand side. There's no Kieran Trippier. Obviously, the right-hand side position is up for debate, the right forward position, whereas Anthony Gordon wants to play on the left-hand side and is strongest there, and Lewis Hall has made the left-back position his own. He feels undroppable at the moment. I mean, for me personally, yes, it is a coin toss. I think I would go for Lewis Hall. Just about in every single metric, he led the way for both sides on Saturday. Not that Leicester led any of the positive metrics, but he had the most. He had 112 touches. He was basically playing both as a left back who would maraud and overlap, but also an inverted left back. He would come inside in the midfield, and you see that sort of ability he's got on the ball. His passing
was great,
very, very good.
Was excellent.
There was a few times where he sort of looked up immediately if he won the ball in his own half, which he did quite often win the ball himself, and then he would just send players in behind Isak quickly. He'd look for Isak or he'd look for Gordon and get it forward. And I thought it was his most assured display. Now, in every single positive, and this is not to try and down talk his performance or anyone else's, in every single positive, and I would reiterate this for like Dan Byrne defending well, is it's hard to reiterate how bad Leicester were. Now, Newcastle made them poor, but and you can only take a positive from it because Newcastle have not gone and been ruthless enough in these matches this season, and they can only take confidence from this. It will have done all of them the world of good. And for Lewis Hall, I think this was really his breakthrough performance. He's had a lot of very, very good displays, but I think you saw the player Newcastle think he can be. He's had some good defensive displays. He's had some good displays where he sort of tried to get involved in the attack, but he put everything together on Saturday, and you see the potential that they saw in him. Those midfield credentials, but shifted to a left-back position and has the engine to get up and down. And yeah, I thought he was very, very, very good.
I think the Leicester point is important, though, Chris. It sounds like you sort of, you know, it almost sounds like we're being mealy-mouthed about the performance, and it's not that, but it feels like we've had so many turning points or potential turning points this season already. And really, this doesn't become a turning point for Newcastle unless they follow it up with another one, and then another one, and then another one, because it's been such an unreliable season. But yeah, Lewis Hall, I thought was exceptional. That point about partnerships is very, very important. Newcastle just haven't had that. They miss Trippier's distribution. They miss his leadership. They miss that partnership down the right-hand side. And so they have to find something else to compensate. And the signs there are, you know, just really, really encouraging. I would throw Dan into the mix for man of the match, but I would definitely throw Sandro Tonali into the mix as well. I just thought he was brilliant. He controlled midfield. Maybe we'll chat about him a bit more later. But on the subject of Lewis Hall, it's just been astonishing. I mean, it's astonishing to think that a year ago, we were all very, very positive about Tino Livramento. He just looked a class above in terms of, you know, in terms of that position, in terms of the kind of young defender coming through. Lewis Hall was lost. And, you know, he was came into the team at the start of the season a few times and was substituted at halftime repeatedly. They were saying around the training ground, it's up to him. He's got to do it in training. He's got to get to grips with what's being asked of him. Didn't really consider himself a natural left back. You know, he'd played there at Chelsea, but was sort of really thought of himself as a midfield player. And now, I mean, he's just... I'm not saying that those positions have been reversed, but I think Livramento has struggled a little bit with his confidence and performances this season. And Hall has just... He's just kicked on so much. So you have to say, well done to him. I know it's been a tough, you know, it's been a tough spell, but he's just been brilliant. And, you know, I think actually, in terms of drawing conclusions, I think we can draw a conclusion about him because I think he's been consistently very, very good and getting better throughout this season. You can't say that about everybody, but you definitely can say it about him. He's just been fantastic.
Chris, at MC Getter on Blue Sky, said, I demand you all devote at least 30 minutes of the pod talking about how good Lewis Hall is, and I think we've just done that. Listener Bev also said, Hall could become the best left-back in the country. On form, Chris, is he that already?
I mean, there's been a lot of talk of that. I don't watch other sides often enough to say that definitively, but one of the reasons why Newcastle took the calculated gamble on him that they did was because they looked around and didn't see many very good fullbacks, but certainly left backs coming through, not just in England, but in general across Europe. So that's why they did dedicate to Lewis Hall and took on this sort of project as he is to sort of transform him into a left back. I still think this comes off the back of he had two difficult defensive games in the last two matches, if we're honest. Certainly he struggled at Brentford, as a lot of players did. So I think that we have to take it in context, but I do think all of the signs are very, very promising, and his development, as George says, in the course of 6 months, never mind a year, is extraordinary.
And talking of combinations, Tonali and Bruno, George, the pair of players who can't play together, they played together and they were excellent.
Yeah, and Tonali carrying on that good form that he showed against Liverpool in that, you know, largely deeper role, the role that Chris, of course, and other young people, insists on describing as number six, even though number six will forever be a centre-half, but a kind of holding midfield role.
Yeah,
Chris, I know, has some points he kind of wants to make about that, but it's been difficult trying to find a way, I think, for Tonali and Bruno to play together. They're both incredible players in their own right, but how they kind of mix and, you know, how they set up, it's tough. And at the start of the season, when Tonali kind of came back into the side, they were giving up so much space in midfield, it just wasn't working. But it just looks like Tonali is sort of born to that role. I met my mate Pete in Sainsbury's. I had a 20-minute chat in the aisles of Sainsbury's.
Are you one of those people who has a chat in the middle of the supermarket and gets in everybody's way? Are you one of those?
Yeah, you're kind of like moving, standing in front of the eggs. It's never a good place to stand that. But Peter is otherwise known as Budapest 69. He's one of the true faith.
Ah, yes.
Massive. But he's an old fart like me, but he was like saying that he thinks Tonali is up there with the best midfielders he's seen play for Newcastle. And it's a kind of good point. I mean, I know there's not a lot of evidence, but when you see a game like that, he just has the ability to pick passes. It's like he's operating two or three passes ahead of everybody else. And like when you look at the great players, when you look at the great teams like Manchester City, not this season, but or Arsenal under Arsene Wenger, the teams where the ball is being moved on so quickly, it's almost like it's happened before it's happened, if you know,
yes.
Know what I mean.
Yeah.
Tonali is one of those players. He doesn't complicate things. He keeps things simple. He keeps the ball moving. He's muscular. He's athletic. And just, you can just purr over Tonali.
How are you watching both Sandro Tonali and Jason Tindall at the same time on Saturday?
I know that, like, I'm just ignoring you. I know that we, like, you know, when for that run of games where Newcastle suddenly started getting results and we thought maybe this was a way forward, when firstly, Bruno came out of the team for the cup game against Chelsea. It was like, well, at least this simplifies matters. But one thing that we did qualify at the time was that Howe will have to find a way to put them both in the team because they're too good. And again, I don't want to draw too many conclusions from what we've seen, but I do think there's a body of evidence, whether it's Palace, whether it's Liverpool, whether it's this game against Leicester, that Tonali is just so suited to that role. It looks really good, really good.
It was also a milestone game for Sandro Tonali because it was the first Premier League match he started since the Aston Villa game and the first game of last season that Newcastle have won.
Wow. Okay.
So it was a big, big match for him in that sense.
He also played for more than 90 minutes as well, Chris, which is something else, you know, something else that hasn't happened all the time, has it?
No, I think Palace was the only other time in the Premier League. So that was important for him. But the point about him playing in the deeper number six role is, if you listen back to an Eddie Howe, it was a pre-match press conference answer last week, and he was asked about why Sandro Tonali hasn't played in that position more frequently. And he basically started by talking about Bruno Guimarães being one of the best number sixes in the Premier League. But then he also talked about, against Liverpool, two of the goals that Bruno is involved in, one of them is in the number six position. And the way that it's working with the two of them now that way around, that it wasn't working really the other way around, is that the two of them dovetail very, very well. If you watch the game back on Saturday and you look at certain moments, if one goes forward, the other drops in, and vice versa. And there's a lot of times where Sandro Tonali is actually on the edge of the penalty area and Bruno Guimarães is a lot deeper for some of the moves that Newcastle make in attack, because Tonali has more of an engine, he has more of an ability to get forward, he can play that sort of role of getting forward. But he is probably, as I agree with George, I like the way that he incisively passes the ball, his quick movement, his ability, one-touch pass and get the ball forward. And he probably has more ability to get back than Bruno does at the moment. Bruno looks a bit leggy still, he still isn't getting them down the pitch well. And so it's almost like a dual role for the two of them, that they are interchanging. I just want to make that point, that it's not that one is a definitive number eight or a definitive number six. The way and the idea from the start was that both of them would dovetail and do a little bit of both. It wasn't really working the other way around. At least the evidence of the last couple of weeks is that maybe it can work better this way. And certainly when you've got a compliant Leicester side, that gave both of them a boost and an idea that it can work. So hopefully that gives them the confidence and more of a know-how that they can work together, because it's a very specific role. It's a detailed role for both of them, and it is going to take time for it to fully work in practice.
And there were early concerns, certainly when Tonali arrived, about if you move Bruno further forward, you then lose a lot of his effectiveness as a player. That was something that Newcastle were very conscious of when Tonali arrived. But it's the same with everything. Even great players can take a while to get to grips with each other. And yeah, there's been a lot of time on the training pitch for Bruno and Tonali to play together, but they've not had the match experience. You know, it's not led to a match experience for 10 months of that. But yeah, it feels like, you don't want to say that this is a solution or that it's a permanent solution, because I think, again, what we've seen this season is that, you know, there's just this sort of inconsistency baked in. I hope not, but it feels good at the moment, and it feels like there's a way forward for now anyway.
It's been a roller coaster.
Newcastle, of course.
It was a match on paper that we should have won, really, but the manner of it was very encouraging, Chris, wasn't it? It could provide a powerful boost.
It could, and just coming on to that, is that reiterating the point that I made earlier about Newcastle's record against teams in the bottom half, teams that are expected to beat at St James's, they hadn't done that. It was only their second Premier League win at St James's since September. So Newcastle's record has not been great on home soil relative to last season. They played loads of matches in that time, but last season and the season before, their home form was basically imperious, and they'd lost that to a certain degree. But also, this was only the third time this season when Newcastle have had more of the ball that they've won a match, and both the other two had been away from home, at Forest when they had 56.3% possession and at Wolves when they had 51.5%. The Wolves one wasn't really a convincing win. They came from behind to sort of nick it, really. And at Forest, they actually were better in the second half when they had less possession that match. Against Leicester, they made it count. They had the ball and they were successful in achieving that. All of their other wins at home had been with very little, about 30 to 35% possession. So they've changed that narrative to a certain degree. At least they've shown they can do it a different way, albeit again, the caveat of it being Leicester and a very poor Leicester side, but it can only be a confidence boost. It was the way they had to start this massive week, and it couldn't have gone any better from that perspective.
Newcastle could have had 7 or 8, George, couldn't they? Jacob Murphy on his own could have had 4 or 5. Alexander Isak also failed to convert a couple as well, didn't he? Although he did play very well, and his goals record is excellent.
Yeah, I think there are moments when he's almost trying to do too much. It feels like that, you know, we know how good he is on the ball. He's like so fluid and fluent on it. It feels like he's trying to take one touch too many sometimes, or sort of trying to do everything. His run of goals is good. Chris, I'm sure, can tell me what it is.
Yeah, well, he became only the third Newcastle player after Alan Shearer, who did it twice, and Andy Cole in the Premier League era to score 20 Premier League goals in a calendar year. But it's also, he's got 6 goals and 3 assists in his last 7 Premier League games.
Yeah, which is a great record, so you can't really complain about that. But I think there is this feeling that he hasn't hit top form in terms of performances. But that's not a bad sign, is it? That he's chipping in with goals very, very regularly. It doesn't feel like it's that sort of instinctive, instant, bang, bang, bang sort of goal-scoring form that, you know, occasionally if you're over-elaborating, it's because you're not, you know, fully confident, perhaps. But, you know, that wouldn't be surprising, because it's been a difficult, bitty season for the team as a whole. But it's not a bad complaint. And, yeah, 20 goals in a calendar year in the Premier League is a really good milestone.
Just picking up on the Jacob Murphy point, I think we should stress more about the impact he's had in the last 2 matches. I mean, the thing about Jacob Murphy is, and Saturday summed him up, because there were moments, as we've said, about the misses that he had, where within a match he confounds, and it's like he's exasperating. But at the same time, he can produce big moments, and Eddie Howe likes him partly for that reason, but also because of the hard work that he puts in. And in the last 2 games, he's had 4 goal contributions. He set up both goals at Brentford, and he scored 2 on Saturday, and he could have scored more. But his reaction as well to scoring the first goal. Now, was he having a jibe back at the crowd, who he had a bit of back and forth
to?
That's
how it felt to me.
Seemingly, we seemed to be shouting water or something exactly at the crowd in celebration, frustration that had been audible within St James's, the frustration that had been aired towards him. But that right forward position has been a problem, and Jacob Murphy started the season in that role. He sort of came out of the team for a while. Newcastle have trialled Harvey Barnes there, they've tried Joe Linton there, they've tried Gordon there. They very rarely have actually tried Almiron, who had been the long-term solution for quite a while there. But Jacob Murphy, having had a couple of injuries, has now come back in and seems to be the man who deserves that position on that. There were moments on Saturday, as I say, which he just passed the ball to the opposition at a certain point, so he just did bizarre things. But he scores 2 goals, having set up 2 in the previous match. He warranted his place in the side, and he warrants his place in the side. You would say, fitness permitting, he should be in the team who plays against Brentford in the massive cup game on Wednesday.
But you have to pay tribute to him for that. You know, yes, this is a position that Newcastle have looked to strengthen for a long time. Nobody expected Jacob Murphy to be kind of fundamental to Newcastle. You know, I mean, a guy that, you know, that arrived under Rafa Benitez, and then, you know, was kind of lost, basically. And he's found a way of becoming really, really, really important. And this is something that, you know, you can't stress enough. Yes, it's a position that Newcastle want to strengthen, but what they need as a team and a club is that the players who are being asked to fill in or who are playing there at the moment to rage against that for as long as they can. And it's been one of the kind of great stories post-takeover that people who've been in and around the team have done everything to remain part of it for as long as they possibly can. I wrote a couple of weeks ago about Dan getting to 100 appearances in the Premier League, something that, I mean, he wasn't, you know, he wasn't on Newcastle's list of targets when he arrived in that January, but they signed him. People might not have thought that he would still be here 100 appearances later, but he is, and that's just one story, but Murphy is another. Fabian Scher is another. I know he had a tough day at Brentford, but like, you need these players to give all of themselves and just show that sort of tremendous desire to remain part of the club for as long as they can. It's been one of the great stories at Newcastle. There's still a chance that this season could go very, very well indeed, and you need everybody to kind of buy into it. And, you know, Murphy's a great story.
He certainly is. Will Osula got 20-odd minutes as well, Chris, didn't he? Howe was able to withdraw key personnel. Have we got enough up top with Callum Wilson out again?
I'd say the answer's no, but that doesn't mean that Newcastle can actually address it. So Callum Wilson is another one who, since our last podcast, he has suffered another hamstring injury. This time, I think it was to his other hamstring, to the one he'd had the previous issue with, and he's going to be out for basically 2 months. So that could have a knock-on effect for January transfers, but I think more in the sense that Callum Wilson isn't going to be sold, or you wouldn't have thought he'd move when he's got an injury. So can Newcastle get his wages off the boot? Can they get it in money for him? What does it mean for the contract that he has, which theoretically Newcastle could exercise a one-year extension clause on it? Will they do that? Unclear at this stage. Now, Willa Sula did get 20-odd minutes. There were a couple of moments, but I think that, and George and I discussed it during the game, I think you can also see how Rory is, and that it's still a work in progress. So I think Newcastle would ideally have another striker in January, but all of the messages so far that I'm getting from when you speak to people inside the club is that it's not going to materially change what they're likely to do in January. How could you, all the issues that there's been before, how could you bring someone in when they know really they're going to be behind Isak in the pecking order? What does it mean for Sula's development longer term? Do Newcastle have the capacity, both wages and PSR room, in terms of transfer fee to bring someone in? All of that seems highly unlikely at the minute. It still looks like centre back, more likely even right sided forward, if Newcastle are going to do anything in January. But yeah, so I think it's unlikely to change things in January.
Agreed on all that, and agreed on Asula. One thing, I mean, I think that spell will be valuable for him, and it's not just in public that they're talking up Asula. The club say the same thing in private conversations as well. They are encouraged by him. They are enthusiastic about him. They do think he's got a chance. Fingers crossed that he continues to develop. It's very tricky because we know week in, week out, Alexander Isak will start if fit, but he also needs competition. He needs to be pushed. And if anything, God forbid, anything happened to him, then yeah, I think Newcastle would be in trouble.
All in all, chaps, a lovely day at St James's Park, especially for listener James Kilpatrick, whose son Ben was a mascot. And James used his behind-the-scenes pass to, according to my notes here, spy on Chris and George.
Our day started with a trip to the media room for the photo. Here we got a glimpse behind the scenes of the press back. George was sitting on the stage, staring back at the rest of the reporters like an alpha male, whilst Chris, although sausageless, seemed to be having fun, sitting alongside Craig Hope. We went down to pitchside to watch the players warm up. Special mention to Jacob Murphy, who came over to play 1-2s with the mascots. This was really appreciated, the mascots loved it. Miggy, Longstaff, Bruno and Tonali also came over to give high fives to the mascots. I then glanced up at the press box, where George and Chris were now sat together, but not speaking. Quite similar to parents who had a bus stop. Shola then came out and was so gentle and welcoming to the mascots and dads. He couldn't have been more friendly and generous with his time, posing for multiple photographs. Ben managed to walk out with Dan Byrne. Dan was brilliant with him, making him feel at ease, talking him through the experience, which was great, as Ben was feeling really nervous about it. All in all, a memorable day. If you can get a message to Dan, just pass on my thanks. He really made Ben's day, and Ben was willing to score throughout the day. Cheers.
I should say well done to James for delivering a very, very upbeat voice note. Thank you for that, and obviously please keep them coming in. But in the style of Chris coming home from Brentford on the train, it's kind of like quite mixed messages, because it was like a beautiful voice note, but delivered like a man really on the edge.
Maybe it was a tiring day for him as well. I imagine he'd be, it would take a lot out of you doing that. But yeah, fantastic to hear from him.
Alpha male Colgan.
Yeah, I don't think that's quite, I don't think that's quite
front,
what I was
in
doing.
In front of running a big silverback gorilla.
Marking his territory. There.
No, it's not alpha male, but well done for spotting the undertones of hatred and aggression that I was definitely feeling towards my colleagues. Yeah, and also well done for noticing Chris and I, our awkward. I mean, we're staying together for the kids, and you know the kids in this analogy is pot on the time. Yeah. So yeah, again, well done for spotting that, and yeah, very pleased to hear that everybody looked after you, and glad that Ben enjoyed it. And of course, we will pass that message on to Dan. No Absolutely. Surprise to hear that he was great.
Lovely stuff. Right, let's have a quick break, chaps, and we'll be back in a moment to talk about that Brentford game.
Take care. You know what it means. Look after yourself. Okay, good luck.
So we've been consistent in our discussion of inconsistency on the podcast this season, haven't we? Everyone involved with the team keen to back up that Leicester performance on Wednesday night against Brentford, Chris.
Yeah, Howe after the match kept repeating that this can't be a one-off. Newcastle have to do this again. It's about backing it up. And he actually was interesting because he sort of said, I just look back at the rest of this season and I can't see. It was almost like, I can't see definitively that we will perform like that. He used the word hope. And it's not just been in public. Newcastle have done that. Discussions with people inside the club privately, it's almost a point that they raise themselves that they know it can't just be Saturday. They have to back this up. And what is the biggest game of the season? It's the most important match of the season. It would have been regardless, I think, to a degree, in Newcastle's league form, because something tangible is that Newcastle have said they want to win a trophy, and this is seems like a great opportunity to do so. They get beyond this, and it would be a two-legged semi-final, and they couldn't have asked for a kinder tie. So it does feel very, very important. But to have gone in on the back of having hammered Leicester 4-0 at home, yeah, that better feel-good factor. Hopefully the nerves are not quite what they were at 3 o'clock on Saturday. That's huge.
It's a huge game, George, isn't it? It's absolutely massive, this.
Yeah, I mean, chatting to Chris about this sort of after the match and sort of how we approach it and, you know, what does it sort of mean? I mean, I think it was important in its own right after Brentford that, you know, that there was a response, obviously. But almost as important as that, maybe more important, is that it clears things ahead of the Brentford Cup game. It is a massive game. It's the biggest game of the season. It has to be, it just because of what's at stake. But, you know, Newcastle are 12th in the Premier League at the minute. That's not where they want to be. Lewis Hall said earlier on the pod that, you know, a couple of wins and they can move back up the table. But it's asking a lot from this position to, you know, to get into the top four, for example, or the top five. It just doesn't feel like it's going to be that kind of season for Newcastle. But they're one game away now from a two-legged semi-final, and it means that they can go into that game with confidence, with some momentum, with wind in their sails. The stadium, hopefully, fingers crossed, will be absolutely, you know, it'll be rammed and it'll be up for it and noisy and everybody feeling positive. And that's why, you know, so there was two reasons why Leicester was important. It was firstly, got to respond. And B, it leaves the way clear for Brentford. I don't want to draw any other conclusions from that. In an ideal world, they then go on, you know, they beat Brentford and then go on to beat Ipswich as well. And then you can say that, okay, well, maybe there's a turning point or maybe things look better. But really, it just means that the way clear is for Brentford now. And Brentford is massive because not only in its own right to get into a semi-final, it means that there's something positive to play for in February, you know, unless obviously they got hammered so badly in the first leg in early January. It keeps the season alive, and it means that Eddie Howe can say to his team, okay, well, we are progressing. Yeah, it's tough in the league. Yeah, we haven't signed anybody. Yeah, okay, there's no new training ground. But here in Newcastle are, they're in another semi-final, and you can go out, you can make yourself legends. It's absolutely vital.
We've got a voice note from listener Jamie S as well.
All right, lads. I was having a chat with my friends the other day and I was wondering if anybody's ever had this thought. We were talking about our Newcastle United mortality rating, whereby you think about how long you've got left going to matches, or indeed how long you've got left to live.
Good Lord.
And you work out how many opportunities Newcastle will have in that time to win a major trophy. So, for example, if you thought you had 30 years left going to matches, you'd have the three domestic trophies, so that would be 90. And then you've got to add on potential European qualifications. So if you thought Newcastle would qualify for Europe half the time, that's 15 times, that's a mortality rating of 105. And then that would drop next week if we were to lose to Brentford. And I do have a question behind all this nonsense relating to that Brentford match, because I think it's a huge, huge point in the season, both in terms of getting past the opponent and getting a semi-final draw if successful. In terms of league form, it seems feasible that we could end up in a pretty benign mid-table slot, which we occupy right now. So my question would be, do we think if Newcastle were to go all the way and win one of the cups, with the League Cup being the most likely, but returned that underwhelming league position, Do we think that would be enough for the ownership to persist with Eddie Howe?
Interesting. I didn't know where he was going with that mortality rate thing at the start. I thought it was maybe something along the lines of how long is it going to take for Newcastle to finish me off? I thought that's where we were going with that. But it's an interesting concept, isn't it? Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. Love that. I love that. I mean, like 5 years ago, it was like I told myself Newcastle were never going to win anything in my lifetime. Same. And life got a lot simpler. And now I don't have that feeling, but yeah, mortality rate. Oh God! So by that mathematics, I've probably got about what 10 mortality rating of 10. I think I can survive for another 2 years.
Get through the next 2 years.
Next two years.
In terms of quickly addressing the question, I think if Eddie Howe was to win a cup this season, it would seem inexplicable that Newcastle would, regardless of the league position. I mean, I don't know that. That's not based on any specific information, but the first Newcastle man to lift a trophy since 1969, first domestic trophy since 1955, I think that it would take a bold call to then move them on.
Yeah. Well, the target was Europe. I mean, the target was Europe before, in early summer, before they then didn't really add to the first team pool. But that was the stated goal of Darren Eales, and then later Paul Mitchell, I think, talked about it too. So winning a cup would ensure Europe, so that would be job done in that sense. But yeah, I totally agree with Chris. I mean, if you win a cup for Newcastle, you're an automatic legend. It's whether you're Howe or the players, and he would certainly earn the right to have at least another season in charge.
Sean Longstaff reached 200 senior games as well. Quite an achievement that. Interesting that these seem to be coming in clumps, though. He's suspended for the cup game. And speaking of suspensions, Joe Linton gets a one-match ban after he hit the threshold for yellow cards. But that won't apply in the cup, so he'll miss Ipswich instead. He wasn't very happy about it, Chris, was he? And I don't think Eddie Howe was either.
He wasn't, no. And I think Eddie Howe wasn't very happy at Joe Linton himself, because Eddie Howe revealed afterwards, and it's very rare for him to do this, that there's a conversation between him and Joe Linton on the side of the pitch where Joe Linton basically said, Joey, don't get booked. And then within 90 seconds, Joe Linton had managed to get
whatever
himself
you
booked
do,
and suspended.
He said, I won't, Gaffer,
don't worry. And then obviously he did. So yes, but it's not ideal. It's an away game, but I suppose given the games that are coming up with the rest of Christmas, and he'd gone 9 matches without picking up that fifth one. So that was a curious quirk.
And yeah, it's absolutely right to draw attention to Sean's achievement too.
Yeah.
I listed players earlier who had kind of risen with the team, risen with the club. He's absolutely one of those. 2 or 3 years ago, he thought that he was going to have to leave. He didn't, and has been a kind of fundamental part of things. He's not in the team at the minute. The midfield solution that we were talking about at the moment doesn't feature him, but I'm sure he would back himself to work his way back into the team, because he's done that along with others.
Ipswich's early season acclimatisation to the league is very much a thing of the past now, isn't it, Chris? That'll be a tricky trip, that one.
Yeah, not just for me, because I'm doing it then back in the day as well, but yes, it will be for Newcastle United. I mean, just remember last Christmas, the game before Christmas Day was Newcastle went to Luton and got turned over against the newly promoted side.
That's right.
Ipswich haven't won at home all season. This will be a huge match for them that they'll be targeting, but Newcastle have to now respond away from home and show that they're not as jumpy as they have been, because they've put in a couple of very good away performances, but also some very, very bad ones.
Just on that subject, of course, it will be the Sir Bobby Robson derby.
Of course.
Newcastle going back to Portman Road, where Sir Bobby, he absolutely kind of rebuilt that club, took them into Europe, won trophies. Absolutely fantastic. Fantastic occasion. Two clubs that have statues of Sir Bobby outside their stadium. And that gives me a nice excuse to mention War Flags, who used, that famous Sir Bobby quote, "It's the noise, it's the passion." And that quote came at the same time as there was a campaign which has been led by the Football Supporters Association. And there was a banner in the Gallagate too about stop exploiting loyalty on rising ticket prices. And the conjunction of those two things together was kind of quite poignant, because, of course, that quote from Sir Bobby is sort of all about the innocence and the beauty of football, falling in love with football, and, not allowing it to be priced out of reach for people who go and watch the game and want to go and watch the game. And so very important. So yeah, just wanted to draw attention to that. Lovely seeing that quote on the Gallagate.
Yes, it absolutely was. Right, thank you to all of our correspondents at podonthetyne.bsky.social on Blue Sky, still at podonthetyne on X and Twitter as well. Emails and voice notes welcome, of course. The address is podonthetyne@theathletic.com. Okay, chaps, that's just about it. Any plans, Chris? You have to watch the under-21s tonight?
I am, yes. I'm forgoing my own attempts to usually play seven-a-side football on a Monday night. I am going along to Whitley Park. Newcastle are playing Chelsea tonight, and hopefully Sven Botman will be in action. I wrote about this after the Brentford game. That was one of the few positives that Sven Botman, for the first time since March, could be playing his first reintroduction back into it. So hopefully that happens and he gets some minutes. And just to draw attention to this, that for a piece that is likely to go up on Wednesday, I've done a long read on James Bunt, who is Newcastle's performance director. He arrived alongside Paul Mitchell in the summer, and there was far more attention drawn to Mitchell given his relationship with Howe. But when Howe spoke about boundaries in the summer, part of that was also to do with Bunt coming in and the effect that he could have, and sort of looking at it, and they've developed a very positive relationship together. There are a lot of changes going on behind the scenes, and despite the injury issues maybe Newcastle have had over the last week, the negative news, things are starting to point in a different direction. So I'd just draw attention to that and point people in that direction.
Right, and there we go. Thanks very much for your time, chaps. Thank you, George.
You're very welcome.
And thank you, Chris.
No problem at all.
And thank you to all of you out there listening as well. From everybody at Pod on the Tyne, have a lovely week. We'll speak to you soon. Goodbye. All in all, chaps, a lovely day at St James's Park, especially for listener James Kilpatrick, whose son Ben was a mascot, and James used his
The Athletic FC Podcast Network.